Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is journalist, writer, critic, children's book author Bruce Handy, and we're continuing our conversation about his film history, Hollywood High, a totally epic, way opinionated history of teen movies. Bruce, welcome back to the show. It is such a pleasure to talk to you about this book.
Oh, thanks. I'm so delighted to be here.
Well, and I want to say this again for the benefit of the audience. Although this is a really enjoyable book, it is also an in-depth, serious film history. I don't know how you did it, but you did do it, and it's unique. And I love the fact that it's fun, but also it is a real film history. Did you intend that? I mean, it was
Oh yeah, absolutely. I'm so glad it read that way to you, because yeah, that was absolutely my intent, because I think the movie, I cover a wide sort of swath of movies, and some all-time great classics, like I think Rebel Without a Cause and American Graffiti.
The Graffiti chapter is again a great standalone chapter, as is the Rebel Without a Cause chapter.
But then, also some, junkier stuff, like, I think we're going to talk about the Beach Party movies today. But, all these things, I think they're so reflective of what was going on in American culture, both, broadly and more specifically, of course, American youth culture. And it just seemed like teen movies were a great lens to look at the, the book kind of starts in the late 30s with the Andy Hardy movies. And it was just, felt like that would be a really interesting lens to kind of look at, American, sort of cultural history and social history over the last, 80 years, something like that. Yeah, I can't do the math very well.
It's really about the marketing to the perceived teen audience. And it's like defining what teen meant. And it's really interesting because this chapter, Frank and Annette, is followed by the chapter on American Graffiti. And we'll talk about that as we go along. But you have a quote at the beginning of this chapter, okay, from my hero, Samuel Z. Arkoff. The last thing teenagers wanted was a lecture during an evening of entertainment. And that, to me, really explains it all, his modus operandi. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, he was a certain kind of genius. I don't know that he was a great filmmaker, but he was certainly, a great, marketer and a great, film idea man. Him and his partner, Jim Nicholson, they sort of, I don't know quite single-handedly, but they certainly helped invent and were certainly, I think, the most successful at the whole idea of drive-in movies. And really what that was about was kind of realizing that teens were a distinct audience, and that, by the 1950s, they started having, a lot of independent income, and, America was getting richer, teens had cars, they just had a lot more, they had both more economic power and more kind of social freedom than they had had, in the pre-war era. And he kind of realized that, hey, this was kind of an untapped market, because most movies before, obviously there had been movies that had appealed to teens, like, Rebel Without a Cause, but in some ways that was almost like catching, lightning in a bottle. That was a movie. In some ways, it's really a movie geared towards adults. It's got an adult framework.
And it did have a message.
Yeah, and kids latched onto it. Partly because that great performance of James Dean, or also Blackboard Jungle, which came out the same year. Which again was a huge movie for teens, because it opened with Rock Around the Clock, which, for a lot of white kids at least, was kind of the first time they were hearing, rock and roll, and certainly at that volume in a theater, that was a revelation. But again, it was a movie really aimed at adults, and there's kind of a message. I mean, there was this whole wave of juvenile delinquents juvenile delinquent movies, but they'd always open with some, you know, some guy would come on, you know, some sort of authority figure would come on and say, well, you know, this is lurid, but this is a really important problem of youth in America. And, you know, this is what we need to, you know, focus on so we can, you know, not lose the war to communists or whatever. Well, you know, Hollywood was kind of trying to have it both ways. We'll give you this kind of, you know, lurid drama of, you know, kids running around in, you know, race cars and, you know, having switchblade fights. But we're also going to make sure that it's clear that this is socially redeeming stuff, because we're examining a problem. You know, these are problems. You know, they were sort of kind of like Pinky. And yeah, sorry, go ahead.
No, but in that line, a book I'd never heard of before that you write about in this chapter, 1963. Teenage Tyranny by Grace and Fred H. Heckinger.
Yeah.
And you know, I lived through these years.
Not wrong. Yeah.
I lived through these years and I forgot how many people were afraid of teenagers or what they were bringing.
Well, it's interesting. You look at the culture of the time, you know, just going through the popular press and like, you know, every magazine was having, you know, they'd have big cover stories, teens, who are they, what are they, what do they want? You know, it was almost like it was treated like they were this kind of, you know, invading army. And there's all these, you know, these interviews with, you know, experts trying to, you know, explain teens to their parents as if, you know, they didn't actually live in the house with them. It was this whole kind of, you know, cultural revolution where these kids had, they had money, they had freedom, they had slang, they were kind of dressing, you know, wearing jeans. There was, you know, by the mid-50s, suddenly you have rock and roll. That's just, you know, that's a whole other thing. So, yeah, a lot of the adults, you know, adults are afraid of that. And, yeah, that book, you know, the book you mentioned, Teenage Tyranny, they're kind of saying, you know, basically teenagers are going to take over the culture, which, you know, in some ways is kind of what happened. I mean, I kind of make fun of that book a little bit, but it's not altogether wrong. But anyways, yeah, going back to so your hero Samuel Arkoff, he embraces all that, him and Jim Nicholson, and they say like, hey, you know, we're not really afraid of this. You know, we're gonna give them what they want. You know, we're gonna give them like, you know, trashy horror movies and sexy delinquent movies and, you know, eventually beach party movies. You know, that was their kind of genius, this kind of meet teenagers where they were.
What it was is, we're going to give you all the lurid teenage stuff, but without the message.
Yeah, exactly. And like that quote, they just totally jettison it. There's no redeeming value in any of this. I mean, they do, you know, at times they kind of, you know, pander to their audience a little bit. I mean, you know, maybe there's kind of a message in something like I Was a Teenage Werewolf, one of their most famous movies before the beach party movies, where, yeah, it's poor Michael Landon's character, you know, sort of put upon by these horrible, you know, adults to do experiments on him. So, you know, maybe you can kind of read, you know, kids can kind of, you know, read into that in some Freudian sense or something. But yeah, but basically it's just, yeah, it's like a scary movie. So you can, you know, you and your day can like grab each other in the scary parts and, you know, when you're at the drive-in or whatever.
Quickly followed by I Was a Teenage Frankenstein.
Exactly. with the same exact, I forget the guy's name, but the same exact actor playing, you know, a different mad scientist. Very good at it.
This let's start out by talking about Beach Party, with the first movie in the genre, 1963. And it wasn't a long thing, run of real beach movies. But what was there?
They really only go till like what, 66, maybe kind of by 67. I think they're dying out a little bit.
Yeah, and so I was talking to somebody about this chapter in the book, and they said, "Well, what about that?" And I was talking about how, you know, nothing really happened. Everything promises sex, but nothing delivers. That's the whole point of these movies. But they said, well, what about, you know, Where the Boys Are? And I said, well, that was not part of the series. That was, you know, because somebody was raped in that. And
that's a whole different thing. Yeah. I mean, that stuff was in the air, though. You know, sometimes you read things where it's like, you know, that like Arkoff and Nicholson and you know, the director, writer-director William Asher kind of invented this stuff out of whole cloth. And that wasn't entirely true because, yeah, there was, I mean, yeah, about Where the Boys Are, which is, you know, college girls, you know, going to, what is it, Fort Lauderdale, getting into trouble. And obviously there was Gidget, you know, from a few years early. And surf music is starting to happen around 1960.
Well, yeah, and actually, I think Dick Dale was in this first movie. Dick Dale was in Beach Fight.
Yeah.
And one of the classic, the surf guitarist, man, bar none. I mean, Dick Dale was in it. But this movie, you're writing about these films is just hilarious because when you're talking about the title, Beach Party, an exploitation film that delivered on the promise of its title, that's what it was. It was a beach party, end of sentence.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's kind of barely plot. You know, they have this kind of silly subplot about, the anthropologist. The poor actor from Saboteur. And, so he's kind of playing this. This kind of stooge of a, you know, anthropologist is trying to spy on the kids and learn about their mating habits. And yeah, and there's some
Bob.
Little,
is it Bob I Cummings? Forget, you know, Bob Cummings?
Bob Cummings, yeah, of course. Yeah, Bob Cummings, exactly. And also of the Bob Cummings Show.
He was in a Hitchcock film, He was in...
Saboteur, which is...
He was also in the one that was filmed in 3.
Oh, Dial M for Murder.
Dial M for Murder.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that was another thing you brought up. You know, as you described this sun-kissed teenage Neverland, it would have some adults there, but they would always be buffoons, and there would be these weird actors who would sort of come in and be in these movies as sort of the joke of the teenagers in this movie.
In the first one, Maury Amsterdam.
Owns
this kind of beatnik club, you know, and they've got him wearing all these weird, like, masks.
And he's wearing a little goatee, too.
Shows up. Yeah.
I feel bad for Buster Keaton. Buster Keaton is in one of the last ones, and it's just the poor classic, you know, film star is just totally underused in that film.
Oh no, it's so sad to see. Yeah, they have him dumb gags like he's at the beach, with a rod and reel casting, and he accidentally hooks a girl's bikini top. You know, it's really. It's really lame. You know, you just feel bad. Like, you know, I guess he got needed a paycheck. But Mickey Rooney shows up in.
Oh God, yeah.
I think in what is it? Oh, How to Stuff a Wild Bikini, I think, is the Mickey Rooney one.
So the return of Andy Hardy. Andy Hardy goes to the beach.
Yeah. Well, then except he plays, he plays another stooge. He's this kind of advertising man who's trying to, like, figure out some way to exploit the kids and, you know, get them to endorse some soda pop he's trying to sell or something. But
my favorite guy is Harvey Lembeck.
Harvey Lembeck, yeah, the motorcycle leader, yeah.
Eric Von Zipper.
Oh, he's got that. Yeah, I know. He's just always getting, comeuppances and stuff,
He was great on the Phil Silvers show.
I'm sorry?
He was great on the Phil Silvers show.
Yeah, well, yeah, exactly. I know you sort of, I know. Well, that's like a lot of these guys. Yeah, if you were just watching these movies, you'd think, yeah, man, who are these, like, hacky guys? But they all had these, they all had these great, you can't do better than, Buster Keaton. And it was too bad he got... stuck in this. I think Boris Karloff shows up. So they had, they had good people. And William Asher, the writer-director, he was a real force in the TV world. He had been a director on I Love Lucy, directed, I can't remember. He either did the Chocolate Factory or the Grape Stomping one. I can't remember. But he directed like dozens of I Love Lucy's, and he went on. He created, the Patty Duke Show, which is a great early '60s sitcom, and Bewitched. So yeah, they had real talent in these things. And for American International Pictures. That was the company of Arkoff and Nicholson.
Let me just do an ID. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is journalist, critic, humorist, and children's book author Bruce Handy. And we're talking about one of my favorite histories this year, Hollywood High, a totally epic, way opinionated history of teen movies. Can we talk about AIP? Because AIP films took up a lot of my childhood. So it was founded.
Were you seeing them at drive-in?
No, I'm seeing them at an old beat-up theater that was at the corner called Paramount Theater. And all of the films would play there. It was founded in 1954 by Sam Arkoff. And who was Sam Arkoff? There's an interesting, you have so much little digressive details that are weird. You're right that he was born.
He's funny, yeah.
He was born in 1918, Fort Dodge, Iowa, and they didn't have a synagogue there, so they had to have their celebration of high holidays in the Knights of Columbus Dance Hall.
Yeah, he sounds like one of those guys that he was just, I think he was just, you know, he was born fully formed. Apparently, you know, I mean, according to his, you know, according to interviews, and he wrote a, you know, pretty entertaining memoir. You know, he loved movies from the get-go. I mean, he would go, you know, he would just go to every movie he could go to. And in those days too, you know, the movies would come in and they'd go in a week, right? Each week you'd get a new, you know, the Warner's Theater would have the new Warner's movie and the Paramount Theater would have the new Paramount. And he would go to all of them. He'd even, you know, he'd cut school to go see them in matinees. You know, he has some quote where he says, well, you know, I figured I could always catch up on algebra, but, you know, the Magnificent Ambersons wasn't going to be there next week or whatever, you know, whatever the movie was. Because, yeah, they didn't have revival theaters then. They obviously didn't have TV. So, you know, movies were kind of, you know, it was a kind of a one-and-done situation. And then, yeah, he ends up going to law school. He goes to law school in Loyola in Los Angeles. And he goes because, yeah, he's not really even that interested in being a lawyer. He just goes out there because he wants to get out to L.A. and you know, get next door to Hollywood. And but before he even graduates I think he's, you know, he's producing like an early sitcom and stuff. So he was just always, you know, I think he just kind of knew from the get-go where he was going in life. I don't know. Maybe he didn't know he was going to get all the way to, you know, I Was a Teenage Werewolf or Muscle Beach Party, but, you know, that he was certainly pointed in that direction.
Another quote from Arkoff: we eventually realized that if we concentrated on movies aimed at the youth market, we might be able to create a literate niche for ourselves. And, they had this thing. Bruce, this really made me just throw the book across the room. It was so funny. They had keywords in every film title. And that was his brainy idea. It should have one of these three words: hot rod, drag strip, or rock and roll.
Yeah, I know. And they just recombine, you know, drag strip, rock and roll, hootenanny, whatever. Yeah, I know. It's almost like they just had a hat and they pulled out three words and that was like their next title.
Well, you list all the films in the book and it's like hilarious how many there are using that magic formula of hot rods, drag strip, rock and roll.
I forget exactly. I don't have the book in front of me. I forget how many I listed.
It's a lot.
I didn't even do all of them because at some point I realized, yeah, people are going to get, you know, people get the idea, you know, but I could have probably done, you know, there was another like six or seven more out of the dozen or whatever that I had. I mean, they would pick up, I mean, again, like, you know, not to keep, you know, dwelling on I Was a Teenage Werewolf, but they came up with the title before they had the film. I think they did that a lot. You know, it's like, hey, that's a great title. Let's make a movie to go along with it.
And they were they came in under budget. I Was a Teenage Werewolf was shot in 7 days. The budget was $82,000, and it made $2 million at the box office.
Yeah, I know. They like their movies weren't like, you know. There was obviously, you know, movies that were making much more at the box office, like, you know, like Ben-Hur or How to Marry a Millionaire or whatever. But yeah, I'm sure in terms of profitability, they had to be kind of leading the pack. I mean, that was kind of what's interesting about the Beach Party movies, because they, excuse me, they put, you know, they actually put a little extra money into those. They shot them in, they shot them in color. And actually, you know, usually they had no, you know, they had no stars, but actually, you know, Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello were actually, you know, pretty, you know, were sort of relatively big names at the time. So, you know, I don't think they were paying them, you know, bundles of money, but they had to shell out a little bit more than they were used to.
You were
so Michael Landon, for instance.
Yeah, go ahead.
He was in Werewolf. You know, Michael Landon was a complete unknown when he was in you know, I Was a Teenage Werewolf, and, you know, basically got paid, you know, I don't know, $1,000 or something. I forget. It's in the book. But
I think it was $1,000. I think it was $1,000 for the whole shoot, yeah. Now, you write that the subgenre, well, let's talk back to beach movies. You describe it as a mix of promising adolescent romance, slapstick comedy, surfing, dancing, and bikini-clad hopefuls. But that the subgenre can be blamed on Italy. In what way?
Well, that's interesting because, yeah, they were Arkoff and Nicholson. They've been buying some films. They've been buying sort of, you know, cheapy European films like, you know, like sword and sandal movies, like some Hercules movies and stuff like that. So they would periodically go to like film markets in Europe just to, you know, see if there was stuff they could buy. And they were there and they saw some, I think it was like a middle-aged romance set at the beach. And they were like, obviously that's not, you know, we're not going to pick that up. That's not our audience. But hey, you know, romance at the beach, that sounds like a good idea. We could, you know, we could do something with that. So they get back, and I guess they, you know, again, they, you know, as is their way, they come up with the title Beach Party, and they commission a script, and then they get, you know, William Asher to direct it. And according to him, it's hard to tell, you know, everybody has a little different story. You know, according to Asher, the original script of Beach Party was a little bit more, you know, kind of more serious. It was more about, you know, kids, you know, spending all their time at the beach and parents being worried about what was going on at the beach, which doesn't really sound like an AIP.
No.
But anyways, that's Asher's story. And in Asher's version, he rewrites it and, you know, comes up with this, you know, basically turns it into this, you know, silly fluff movie. Although, it's interesting because to Asher, it actually been, you know, kind of before he, you know, between World War One and when he starts, you know, directing in TV, he had sort of had a period of kind of being a beach bum himself. So he actually knew, he actually surfed and he knew surfers and he knew that life and that, you know, there was, he had some natural affinity to that and the kind of the, you know, that the sort of endless summer vibe of, surf documentary. But yeah, just that kind of freedom and lack of responsibility, you know, that these movies are all about, because there's no, you know, there's no teachers in them, there's no parents, you know, the only, you know, you can't even really call it, you know, the adults in them authority figures, you know, they're just these sort of cartoon adults. That, you know, that came out of something real in Asher's life. So maybe, you know, maybe there was that certain kernel of, you know, something real that, you know, maybe helped rise, you know, those movies kind of rise above the pack a little bit. I don't, you know, I'm being very generous there, I think.
But, I think you are. I just want to mention Annette Funicello, though, who previously was known by young people from the Mickey Mouse Club as the oldest Mouseketeer. But she also started to develop a film career. She had been in The Shaggy Dog and Babes in Toyland and stuff like that. But Disney gave her the word that she had to remain pretty pure. She had to as you write in the book, an avatar of wholesomeness.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. Yeah, I mean the big controversy about that, because they, I guess she was under contract to you know, Walt Disney. It was still that, you know, it was still the kind of the end of the old studio era where, you know, stars would be under contract to a specific studio. So AIP had to, you know, get Disney's permission, you know, had to get Disney's permission to hire her for this. So they sent him Arkoff sent him the script, and, you know, according to both Arkoff and Annette Funicello, you know, he says, well, you know, this seems like, you know, harmless, good, you know, good, clean fun. Maybe it's a little racy, but he just said, you know, he said, Annette, he sits down with Annette and says, Annette, you know, I'm happy if you do this movie, but just one thing, you know, I don't want you to wear a bikini. I don't want you to show your navel.
Right, the navel thing.
That was, that was like a huge, that at the time was, you know, a huge deal. Cause I guess, you know, it's interesting. I was looking through all the, you know, there's all these kind of various iterations of the Hollywood production code, you know, that was enforced from the, you know, the 30s into the 60s. And I never saw anything that said specifically says you couldn't show navels, but it was kind of widely it was sort of certainly understood among all the, you know, the studio heads and filmmakers in Hollywood that you couldn't show a navel. That was, you know, verboten. You know, if you ever, you know, if you watch, you know, I Dream of Jeannie.
Oh, that was a big deal. That was, you know, that show.
Which comes out after this. Yeah. They never show her navel. It was a big deal. Apparently in Dr. No, which comes out a year before Beach Party, when Ursula Andress is wearing a bikini and you see her belly button. There's plenty of belly buttons in Beach Party. And actually, at some point in the movie, there's a couple scenes where you actually see Annette's belly button too. I don't know if they just got sloppy
We're almost out of time. And I just want to say that the end of every Beach movie ends with Frankie and Annette still in love, her virtue intact. Now, Mad Magazine does a parody of the Beach movies, as you write about, and Samuel Arkoff goes, maybe it's time to move on, and we're going to end on this. And he discovers the Wild Angels with Peter Fonda, so motorcycles, and The Trip, acid and LSD, 1967. And so Arkoff just moves on to the next natural exploitative films, and those are it. But he passed on Easy Rider.
They really changed too, because the Wild Angels is a nasty.
We got to end. We're completely out of time. And returning guest tonight is journalist, critic, humorist, and children's book author Bruce Handy, and we've been continuing our conversation about his film history, Hollywood High, a totally epic, way opinionated history of teen movies. As you could probably tell, we could talk about this book for years. Bruce, it's been a pleasure.
A pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.